There was no deal, just a guilty plea. Luigi Mangione admits he stalked UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson and shot him to death ambush style. Some folk hero. USS Abraham Lincoln, on a record-long deployment due to the war with Iran, hasn't been at sea long enough. That coming today from President Trump. We will run that answer by Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal, who believes the vessel and its crew are overtaxed and need a break. President Trump's hand-picked Kennedy Center board keeps trying to slap his name on the Performing Arts Center and now wants to close it for 2 years. Ohio Democratic Congresswoman Joyce Beatty, on the board, but not on board, joins us with the legal fight ahead. Hello, everyone. I'm Major Garrett in Washington. Welcome to The Takeout. So it ends. Luigi Mangione did it. All of it. Perhaps now the sickening spasms of folk hero sympathy can find another outlet or slink away in newly discovered self-awareness. Mangione had defense counsel, and that defense counsel on his behalf contested evidence and procedures, as was his rights under the Constitution and their obligations as his attorneys. But along the way, something strange happened. A sort of Avenger cult status began to attach to Mangione in certain segments of American life. Did he actually do it? Was he striking a blow against the system? Was the evidence gathered legally? Nonsense. Mangione did not cut a deal. He admitted guilt. Defense attorneys typically resort to sanitizing language in moments like this. It is a professional obligation. Here is Karen Friedman Agnifilo.
With today's guilty plea, Mr. Mangione has accepted full responsibility for the death of Brian Thompson, arising from the events of December 4th, 2024, outside of the UnitedHealthcare Investor Conference here in Midtown Manhattan. It was a single tragic event.
Arising from the events of December 4th, a single tragic event. Prosecutors, as is their habit, were more specific, more direct. This is Jamie McDonald, U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York.
At 6:45 on a December morning, Luigi Mangione stalked and murdered Brian Thompson in cold blood on a public sidewalk in Midtown Manhattan. It was deliberate, calculated, and premeditated. In the days leading up to the murder, the defendant very carefully prepared for the attack. He tracked Mr. Thompson's whereabouts, conducted surveillance along the route he knew Mr. Thompson would take, and positioned himself to carry out the plan.
Mangione's defense attorney tried to underscore a sort of context to the crime, the subtext being this is why Mangione developed, as he did, this kind of cult following.
He endured years of severe, debilitating pain following a broken back while struggling to navigate our healthcare and health insurance systems. Like the thousands of people who've reached out since this tragedy to share their own experiences, he believed that the system had failed him and destroyed his life.
The prosecution had an answer to that contention, and it's one worth remembering in these agitated times.
We live in a civilized society governed by the rule of law. We debate, we disagree, we protest. We do not commit murder. No grievance, political belief, or ideological cause can ever justify murder. There can be no celebrity in assassination. Any person who celebrates, encourages, or excuses actions like these is fundamentally wrong.
With what went down in court and what's next, and that's important, we turn to CBS News legal contributor Jessica Levinson. So what went down?
So what went down is Mangione pleading guilty to the federal charges, not based on an agreement, but instead deciding to plead open. And of course, we can talk about why that happened, but it's not as unusual as it is in state court. What we saw today is Mangione making factual admissions about why he was guilty and going through, Major, what we typically see, as you know, in a decision to plead guilty, where a judge wants to make sure that when somebody is doing potentially one of the most serious things they can do, which is to give up their freedom, that they're doing so knowingly and voluntarily. The judge wanted to make sure you understand exactly what you're pleading guilty to. Nobody forced you to do this. And now walk me through and tell me a little bit about what led you to commit those crimes. So it was a very consequential day in court.
And what's next, Jessica?
So what's next is a couple of things. Obviously, in federal court, Mangione is going to be sentenced. And I think part of his decision to decide to plead guilty is that he wants to not just avoid trial, but he's hoping that the judge views his acceptance of responsibility as a mitigating factor. We know that he was facing up to life in prison. Obviously, he wants the judge to give him far less than that. And then what's next in another case? Well, in the New York case, he is also facing murder charges. And I think that's part of the reason you might have seen this guilty plea, is that what he's hoping, and I think this is an uphill battle, but we already know he's filed a brief, or his lawyers have, what he's hoping is that under New York's double jeopardy law, that the entire murder case is tossed out. Now, we can talk about why I think that's an uphill battle, but that was scheduled to begin September 8th. I don't think it will, because I think there will be a lot of litigation about that particular double jeopardy law. But that's the thing we look to next.
So let's go to that. Why do you believe it's an uphill battle, Jessica?
So if you look at New York's law, which is much more protective of defendants than the Constitution, which, as you know, also prevents against double jeopardy, meaning that you can't have somebody tried twice for the same crime. Under the Constitution, Major, as you know very well, the federal government and the state government are separate sovereigns, so you can face federal charges and state charges for substantially the same acts. But there's a New York statute, and the general rule is you cannot face successive prosecutions based on the same set of acts or conduct. So this looks like it's great for Mangione, but wait and look at the exceptions. The exceptions are good for the prosecution. The exceptions basically boil down to if the two crimes, in this case, federal stalking and the state murder charges, if the elements are substantially different and the harms you're guarding against are substantially different, then you can have that next prosecution. And I think there's a very good case to be made that a federal stalking charge is substantially different enough from a state murder charge.
Walking us through it at all, Jessica Levinson, thank you so much. I appreciate it. As our Charlie Daggett told you on this program last night, the aircraft carrier USS George Washington is en route to the Middle East to replace the USS Abraham Lincoln, where families of some crew members report maintenance problems, supply shortages, and intensifying mental and physical fatigue. The Pentagon admits delays for some typical onboard supplies. It denies undue stresses, physical or mental, for the sailors and Marines aboard. I want to welcome back Charlie, who's got the latest on this. Charlie, what do we know?
Well, help is on the way. You know, as we talked about yesterday, and we got the confirmation, as far as actually rotating out the Abraham Lincoln, not just putting another carrier into that region, that's exactly what it's there for. And it can't come quickly enough, because as we've been covering this for the past few days and other media outlets as well, more families have been coming forward, families that we've spoken to about this. So this hasn't really gone away. There have been more problems, issues exposed, mental health issues, which is really what caused a lot of concerns, but also, you know, shortage of basic supplies, plumbing issues. Just, you know, the wear and tear, not only of a carrier that's out there for that long, but for the individuals who are responsible for maintaining that carrier. And again, I just want to point out, when we talk about a 9-month deployment, that's long, but a 9-month deployment in a kinetic, a war zone, including more than 200 days without a break, that is what's grinding down some of the personnel.
And Charlie, I talked to you about this last night, but you've been on the Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. The acting Navy Secretary Hung Cao put out a statement today saying that that aircraft carrier had engaged in this deployment in more than 10,000 sorties. give my audience a sense of what kind of tempo that is and what kind of stress that puts on the material on board and the personnel responsible for making sure those things go off and go off well.
Right. This is a big hulking thing with a lot of moving parts. And you've got aircraft, fighter jets, and these things are running. In order to get those kind of numbers up and that kind of ordnance dropped, that's day and night. And even when I was there, when they weren't even in a fight, they were going, the F-18s were flying off that deck throughout the night, and they weren't even dropping bombs then. That was for surveillance and obviously for force protection. In a kinetic environment like that, where they're dropping bombs, that would be exhausting, because remember, all of that stuff has to be maintained. As soon as these things come in, and you may have seen some of these images, 30 seconds, they got to move out of the way, the next one goes down, comes in, moves down. Think of that tempo. And they're also worried about coming under attack, which they've had to fend off Iranian drones, missile strikes. They're right at the Strait of Hormuz. So, you know, they're in the lion's den. This isn't just floating around. This is why the intensity, and it's clearly having an effect on morale, at least morale, and the exhaustion, if not mental health issues of that crew.
Which the acting Navy Secretary did concede today, that there are disruptions and there are stresses. War is hell, he said, and normal routines are disrupted. Charlie Dagen, thank you so much.
Thanks, Major.
Later this hour, I will be joined by Connecticut Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal, who is seeking more information about conditions and capabilities remaining for the USS Abraham Lincoln. I want to turn now to CBS News national security contributor Sam Vinograd. Sam, always a pleasure. Your sense of this?
My sense is, if we take a step back and look at just how this is being perceived globally, we certainly have the attrition in military assets because of the situation in the Middle East. We have Ukraine basically begging the United States for additional Patriot interceptor missiles. Remember, we're about a year away tomorrow, the one-year anniversary of President Trump's meeting with Putin in Alaska. And there's just this general sense globally that the United States military is under a historic level of pressure and is really unprepared to not just tread water in this moment, but also to plan ahead and to consider threats, for example, emanating in the Asia-Pacific region. So it is becoming a potential moment of vulnerability for the U.S. more broadly.
Stresses on personnel, stresses on munitions, and stresses on preparedness.
Certainly. And we're embroiled in the Middle East. We have had drone attacks against two Emirati tankers in the Strait of Hormuz a few hours ago. We have this really difficult situation on the tanker. And we are just literally facing a critical shortage of Patriot interceptor missiles that are critical to defend our allies like Ukraine, but also to defend Americans. As this war in the Middle East continues, Iran's strategy might become similar to Russia's. Russia's strategy in Ukraine 4 years in is to really degrade Ukrainian air defenses, to just fire so many missiles that Ukraine runs out of interceptors. In the Middle East, we have so many personnel, so many bases. It sure looks like Iran's strategy may be to try to fire so many that we just can't defend our own personnel anymore.
To that point, Charlie, you're still here, and I'm glad you are. There was reporting in the Wall Street Journal about the United States military and Ukraine going through an exercise with drones, and the Ukrainians, as I read the story, sort of running the table.
Oh, they routed them.
They routed the United States forces.
Absolutely. It wasn't even close. And they did it quickly.
Why does that matter?
Well, it exposed the weaknesses in especially drone defenses. If you send in the armored division in a sort of traditional style, they are prone to Ukrainian strikes or drone strikes. And the Ukrainians have learned this over the years of fighting these battlefields. But at the same time, the Americans have been there with the Ukrainians in Germany learning Russian tactics, right? So it was
better to learn this now, is what I hear you saying.
Indeed, and I also have to, there's one caveat here, that this wasn't sort of the A-team, because as this is going forward, they are developing a sort of rapid reaction force specifically to deal with drones. And that wasn't part of that, yes. That wasn't the sort of the front line, because that's still under development right now, but it's an entirely different unit. But they were burning
all respect to those who were participating, the kind of a B-team.
In a manner of speaking, yes. Yeah.
No offense, please.
No. And they didn't put their most advanced stuff forward because they wanted to see what reality would look like now. Not what they're preparing for, but if it were to happen now. And it showed that these mechanized divisions are vulnerable. They were burning through it so quickly that they had to resupply in order to keep the exercise going. And toward the end of the exercise, the Ukrainians switched teams and helped out the Americans in order for them to develop some kind of defense about what was coming after.
Sam, I'm going to give you 30 seconds to summarize your thoughts on this.
Military pressure, we're talking about that, but there are economic tools that the administration is focused on. So Secretary Bessent has said that the administration is going to unveil new economic sanctions to cripple the Iranian regime. We'll see if those target countries like China, who continue to import Iranian oil. And certainly the Senator Graham Russia sanctions bill is going to go before the House
when they get back at the end of the month.
And that could be significant as well.
Sam Vinograd, Charlie Daggett, great to have you here. Awesome stuff. And joining us now is CBS News Chief White House Correspondent Nancy Cordes from the North Lawn of the White House. Nancy, what do you have on this particular topic that we've been kicking about here for the last 5 or 6 minutes?
Well, President Trump actually had a lot to say about the Iran war when he was speaking at a rally in Long Island a short time ago, Major. He argued that the blockade, the U.S. naval blockade of Iranian ports, has been unstoppable. He described it as a wall of steel, although, of course, it should be pointed out that the whole goal of that blockade is to impose so much economic pain on Iran because it can't get its oil to market that Iran then gives up and reopens the Strait of Hormuz. And so far, that hasn't happened. The president also, interestingly, acknowledged that people on Long Island and all across this country are paying more for gas than they were 6 months or a year ago. But he argued that it has all been worth it, that he is doing the nation a service, in fact, doing the entire world a service by demolishing Iran's military and by attempting to rid Iran of its nuclear ambitions, though it should be pointed out that there, too, he has faced an uphill battle and hasn't been able to strike a nuclear deal with the Iranians yet.
And Nancy, I want to ask you about something Vice President J.D. Vance told Fox News. Quote, goal number one for the administration right now, the vice president said, is to keep oil and gas prices down. He said the second goal is to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. That sounds like a shift, a pretty sizable one, an emphasis.
Yeah, he's actually all week long been saying things that seem to indicate that the goal of ridding Iran of its nuclear ambitions is proving to be far more difficult than President Trump initially thought. Earlier in the week, he said that, they're looking to see if Iran wants to have good relations with the United States as they try to strike a deal. And if not, that's okay. Well, that's a big change from President Trump's assertion at the very start of this war that the whole reason that they were doing this, goal number one, was to get rid of Iran's nuclear program for good. And it is an acknowledgement that as we near the six-month mark of this conflict, they really don't appear outwardly to be much closer to striking a nuclear deal with Iran than they were months ago.
With the latest from the White House, Nancy Cordes, as always, thank you so much. Congresswoman Joyce Beatty sued the Trump administration over the Kennedy Center renaming and won. At least she thought she did. She'll join us to discuss the board's recent vote to name it after Trump again and the phone call in which that happened that the president took part in. Plus, what does a $500 million government contract get you? ProPublica has new reporting that a taxpayer-funded artillery plant spent more than $500 million to build ammunition and produced nothing. Italian police have recovered millions in stolen art taken during a museum heist that looks either Hollywood-inspired or Hollywood-worthy. You're watching The Takeout. We'll be back in 90 seconds. Welcome back to The Takeout. The Kennedy Center board, which is comprised mostly of people appointed by President Trump, voted yesterday to put the president's name back on the building and close it for 2 years. This despite a court order blocking both of those maneuvers. Ohio Democratic Congresswoman Joyce Beatty joins us now to discuss all this. She previously filed a federal lawsuit challenging the president's changes to the Kennedy Center and was on the conference call in which yesterday's decision was made. Congresswoman, always a pleasure to have you on this program. Describe the phone call. How long was the president on it, and what was it like?
The president actually came on as we were getting ready to vote, said he had been listening for the entire meeting, which was about an hour in our meeting time. It was very interesting. interesting because we're just revisiting the same thing. This time, he wants to put an inscription at the bottom of the John F. Kennedy Memorial's name. But my lawyers will file a joint report on this Tuesday, in which we'll notify the court about the actions that were taken in the board meeting and the latest development. The government must also already meet the court's order to talk about when the tarp will come down. And so we are going back to court. This is something that the board has brought up again. And of course, you have to remember that the $257 million that was in the bill, government taxpayers' dollars. So again, Donald Trump wants to take credit and use this as a billboard for his name. And we're going to go back to court as much as it takes. We've been victorious on this because it's unlawful. And even what he's requesting the board to do, it's not lawful, so we'll have to settle this once again in court.
Congresswoman Beatty, what in the course of the 2 hours did you and other board members learn about the necessity, if there is one, to close the Kennedy Center for 2 years? Who would fix it and what fixes would be undertaken?
Well, we did have a report from the consultant who had sent us one of the reports that had a lot of mechanical information and changes, like we need to restore and repair the parking garage. But here was what was interesting. The rest of it was in a two-page PowerPoint. While there was significant discussion on it, there was some unrest. What does partial closing it down? What will it be like if we close the main building for 2 years? That's what ultimately the board voted on at the encouragement of Donald Trump. But we will have activities in the Reach Center. But let's talk about how many employees will lose their jobs. How many employees will it be needed? What will the actual programming be? And what will we do with those existing clients that we're negotiating with? So while the board meeting was almost 2 hours, we're still talking about a historical memorial and shutting it down for 2 years on the hope that there will be an endowment that will raise hundreds of millions of dollars to restore it. So I was not comfortable with closing it for the 2 years. I was not comfortable with having a surprise agenda to item to have Donald Trump's name inscribed or inscripted, which also is not something that you can do by law. So we still have a ways to go to make sure that we can come together and hopefully be able to recognize what the statute says, because it is only the United States Congress that could do what he has asked to be done.
So to be clear, when you go back to court, you're going to fight over the name inscription, and also you're going to fight over the shutting down for 2 years?
Yes, because you have to understand, what we voted on yesterday, we are still in litigation without having a response to this. So technically, the 14-day window that they put in there is we have to go back to court within that. So I want the public to know, because as you can imagine, I'm getting hundreds and hundreds of calls, as are other board members, I'm sure, about what is the status of this? Can he really do this? And the answer is, It was unlawful for what he's done, and we're going to continue to go to court to fight for it.
Congresswoman, you made reference to hopes of an endowment growing to support some of this work, but I don't need to tell you that the Kennedy Center for Performing Arts has suffered some manner of reputational harm in the last year. Artists are pulling back, if not canceling entirely. Ticket sales are down based on all credible reporting. Is this place going to be able to raise hundreds of millions of dollars in an endowment when it's reputationally harmed as it has been?
Well, I think it was reputationally harmed because Donald Trump's name went up on the building. Thus, we saw people pulling out strictly for that reason. The name has come down. There is some excitement and hope. the endowment fund that was established in the name of Donald Trump. I can't take that part away. He is saying he is the most prolific fundraiser in the country, and he will raise hundreds of millions of dollars for the endowment. So that's his name online to do it. He has assured the board that he can do it. Now, set that aside. I think that there are a number of individuals out there who want to return to the Kennedy Center and perform. They did not leave the Kennedy Center, but for Donald Trump making it political and unlawfully putting his name on it. So we've taken the name down. There's a lot of excitement about coming back. And I won't argue or dispute that the Kennedy Center needs renovation. And the board is putting a plan together to do that. I think it was vague. I didn't agree with the report and how it's being done. But at some point, we will need to move on because this is our only living memorial dedicated to John F. Kennedy. And I am very clear that I will continue this fight. And I am very comfortable that we will be able to bring artists back within the next couple of years, if that's what we have to do. But
board member
people are
and
not
Ohio,
saying they don't want to.
Right. Joyce, I appreciate the time. Congresswoman Joyce Beatty, Ohio
Thank
Democrat,
you.
Board member, Kennedy Center. Thank you so much. An arrest has been made in connection to vandalism at the World War II Memorial. We've got some details on that when we come back. Welcome back to The Takeout. Thanks for hanging out with us. Here is a look at what else we and now you are watching this evening. Sources tell CBS News the U.S. Army is grounding all Apache helicopter flights after the fatal crash earlier this week near Fort Hood. In a statement, the Army said, quote, "The stand down will remain in effect until we have a better understanding of the root cause of the accident. We currently have no additional information to share," unquote. U.S. Attorney for Washington, D.C., Jeanine Pirro, announced the arrest of a woman for vandalism at the World War II Memorial. Yesterday, the fountains at the memorial were filled with soap, and a wall was painted red with graffiti that read, quote, "Clean hands, dirty money." On social media, President Trump wrote, quote, "There can be no greater insult to those American heroes who died in World War II." Italian police have recovered stolen art valued at more than $10 million. 5 months ago, paintings by Cezanne, Renoir, and Matisse were taken from a private museum in northern Italy during a late-night heist. Two masked men broke the glass panel of the front door and, as you can see, moved through the museum with flashlights and pretty easily removed three paintings from the wall. No suspects have been identified. But an Italian news agency says 9 people are under investigation. The Trump administration is pushing Congress to increase the defense budget from $1 trillion annually to $1.5 trillion. As lawmakers debate that big ask, a new report from ProPublica reveals one $533 million contract for howitzer shells destined for Ukraine did not produce a single usable shell from its factory. $500 million up in smoke, as you will hear, literally up in smoke. Thus far, no accountability or repayment. Jesse Coburn is the author of that article and a defense reporter at ProPublica. He joins us now. Jesse, it's tremendous reporting on your behalf. Explain to my audience that this is not a Biden or Trump thing. This is a Pentagon procurement thing, a hurry up and get it ready thing, and a Ukraine thing.
That's right. The saga of this factory spans both the Biden and the second Trump administrations. During the Biden administration, there was an enormous push to ramp up artillery production domestically to support Ukraine. And the Biden administration basically threw money at this project, awarding the defense contractor General Dynamics lucrative no-bid awards that went into building a new artillery factory in Mesquite, Texas, which is outside of Dallas. And that factory to date has not been able to produce a single usable shell. And that issue has continued into the Trump administration, which now oversees the factory, and recently negotiated a confidential settlement with General Dynamics that is allowing the company to continue operations at the factory, but is not requiring the company to pay a penny back of the $533 million in taxpayer money that it received for it.
Jesse, there's vivid reporting in your story, and I mentioned this, things going up in smoke. Paint that picture for my audience.
Sure. The core problem at this facility was that it relied on machines provided by a Turkish company called Repcon, and those machines were untested for this sort of artillery, and they ended up failing in, frankly, absurd and ridiculous ways. There were these giant robot arms in the factory that workers told me would catch fire occasionally. They would smash into things. The giant press machines required regular beatings with a sledgehammer to function properly, but they still botched nearly every shell. Other machines in the factory were cracking the shells, deforming them, and even simple equipment, conveyor belts, pipes were malfunctioning in kind of preposterous ways.
There's a quote from the article I want to share with my audience. Compared to the multi-billion dollar budgets of other DoD projects, the financial cost of the Texas debacle is small. But the lack of consequences for the companies involved, in the view of defense spending critics, is symptomatic of a larger problem, a deep-rooted culture at the Pentagon and in Congress in which expensive failures lead only to more spending. That seems pretty topical when the administration wants an extra $500 billion for the defense budget.
That's right. And some defense spending critics fear that wasteful defense spending will grow exponentially if President Trump succeeds in increasing the defense budget to $1.5 trillion. Just to put that in perspective, that would be more than the country was spending on defense annually at the height of World War II. Even under smaller defense budgets, there's long been concerns about waste and bloat in the Pentagon budget. So the idea that the budget could rise even higher has some concern that failures like this Texas factory could have more of them to come.
And there was an Inspector General report that helped form the basis of some of your reporting, but you described it as tepid. Has there been anyone that you've encountered that's sort of pounding on a desk saying, this is an outrage, we need to do something about this?
No, not really. Yet the Inspector General report's recommendations were fairly mild. Neither the Army nor General Dynamics took responsibility to the Inspector General in response to that report. Members of Congress have raised concerns in the past about the performance at this facility, but since our report came out earlier this week, I don't believe any of them have made statements criticizing the lack of performance here.
Thorough reporting. ProPublica's Jesse Coburn, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Senator Richard Blumenthal on the USS Abraham Lincoln and the strategic risks that might be posed by moving the USS George Washington to the Middle East to relieve it. He's next. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. Welcome to the Conversation Corner. Connecticut's Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal was one of the first lawmakers to raise concerns about conditions aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln. And Senator Blumenthal joins me now. Senator, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. The acting Navy Secretary Hung Cao put out a statement today saying that there have been a small number of mental health cases on the Lincoln, treated with no loss of life, he emphasizes, then goes on to say, quote, "There is no question our young men and women have been pushed to their limits, but they have never broken. They are rightly tired, but have never been out of the fight." Do you consider that statement, Senator, at least a concession that the military is acknowledging there are issues to be dealt with here?
I wish they were more explicit in acknowledging that there are issues, but it is a beginning. I consider it in some ways disrespectful to fail to face absolutely candidly the fact that conditions on the USS Abraham Lincoln are abhorrent. Lack of clean water and sufficient nutritious food, but also the mental strain and stress and anxiety that is produced by being at sea without a port call for a record continuous time and the prospect of no immediate relief. Yes, the USS George Washington is supposedly on its way, but the time of its arrival is indefinite, and they are dealing with a ship that itself is in need of maintenance and repairs in many respects. So I think it's a kind of roundabout acknowledgement that they need to face facts here, and I hope that they do.
The acting Navy Secretary also implied that press coverage of this was trying to portray families of service personnel and the service personnel themselves as victims. How do you regard that?
The press has really been a tremendous asset here. It has contributed to our understanding about what's happening on the Abraham Lincoln. It has basically reported what the sailors and their families have told Stars and Stripes and Military Time and other outlets. So I consider the press to have performed a public service here. And in fact, the Pentagon has virtually concealed what's happening until recently, when this indirect, somewhat vague acknowledgement is provided by the Navy Secretary. In my view, what's happened here is in many ways a betrayal of trust by the Pentagon's top leaders, because they have failed to provide what the sailors on that ship need to avoid hardship. And let's be very clear, when a member of the military raises their right hand, they know they're going to endure some hardship. But they should expect that our leaders should do everything possible to avoid additional hardship, not contribute to the hardship. And the failure to deliver mail and care packages, proper food, and provide for basic necessities contributes to the tremendous stress of dealing with an aircraft carrier in combat. These aircraft carriers, as you know, perform 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, not only enabling planes to take off and land, but also fending off attacks from missiles and drones, providing the kinds of repairs that are needed.
These things do not occur in isolation, Senator. As you know, as a member of the Armed Services Committee, when you move one aircraft strike force from one part of the world to another, you are creating potentially strategic vulnerabilities. The George Washington will leave the Pacific. What does that mean to you?
You know, China's watching. The USS George Washington is our foremost aircraft carrier in the Far East, right under China's nose. Withdrawing it from that theater means leaving it potentially vulnerable and moving it to the Middle East may be necessary from the standpoint of this war, but it shows how the war has made us a lot less safe. It has made America less safe. It's made the world less safe. The Iran war, without clear objectives, having accomplished none of the president's goals, is just weakening our military. It is imposing operational stress on our aircraft carriers and destroyers. It's making our sailors go through the kind of stress that could and should be avoided. And of course, taking the George Washington away from the Far East leaves that part of our military defense more vulnerable.
Connecticut Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal. I appreciate the time, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Vice President J.D. Vance says Republicans cannot combat interest among the young in socialism with slogans about the virtues of the free market. Our reporter panel will react to that and a lot more when we come back. Do that from the Takeout Tavern, which I know you're excited about. Welcome back to the Takeout. Welcome to the Takeout Tavern. Reporter panel time. Julia Manchester, White House correspondent for The Hill. Julie Grace Brufke, Capitol Hill reporter and founder of the Sources Say newsletter. So we have a beverage here. It is called a Ginger Paloma, which is the name of a drink. It is not a handle on OnlyFans, okay? Here we go. I'm going to pour that out, all right? You tell us what's in this, Julie Grace, because it's your idea.
It's got sparkling, so we've got like soda water, tequila, and then there's like a ginger beer situation going on there.
And remember, kids, it's always coffee with me because I got to keep my wits about me. You please enjoy.
Cheers.
Please enjoy. Cheers. There we go. That's what we do at the tavern. All right. So I want to play a soundbite from J.D. Vance because he talked about socialism and its attractiveness to young Americans and what Republicans ought to be mindful about when they try to deal with it. Let's listen.
Our response to that can't be just to ignore the economic concerns that I think are feeding this rising interest in socialism. And I guess I would say to that young person that you as an American citizen deserve to have a good life in this country, and you deserve to have a government that is making it easier for you to start a family, for you to afford to get a good education, for you to have a good job, for you to afford a home. And what I would...
He also said that Republicans can't just fall back on slogans about free market virtues.
You know, it's interesting because we've seen the Trump administration continue, despite the fact that we've seen economic indicators suggest the economy is not necessarily picking up. They've continued to say it's happening, everything's okay, it's going to get better, et cetera. But people aren't feeling that. And I think that's what J.D. Vance is acknowledging there. And I think there's a lot of deja vu because we heard the same thing during the Biden administration and during that campaign, the Trump campaign calling them out. So I think this is J.D. Vance really trying to maybe inject some reality at a time when voters are really going to start to pay attention ahead of the midterms.
That's one part of it. Julie Grace, there's another part of it, because just this week, the president stopped saying communists. He started saying jihadists when describing those on the far progressive left. J.D. Vance is not using any of that terminology. He's saying, wait a minute, there's a legitimate argument here, and we better figure out a way to talk about it.
I mean, yeah, I mean, that's definitely a thing. And it's hard to see that talking point not being used by Democrats as you're heading into the midterms. And I've talked to a couple of Republicans.
And undercutting the president about communists and jihadists or some sort of thing.
I mean, I feel like both talking points, there are some moderate Republicans that aren't real thrilled either way. But I mean, I do think that we've looked at how some of these primaries have panned out, and Democratic socialists have been prevailing. I mean, you look at some of these races in New York.
It's a mixed bag. Some places, some more momentum than others. But clearly there is something ascendant, at least in the conversation on the Democratic side.
In the conversation on the Democratic side, but also among younger voters, and maybe among younger voters who were interested in Trump world in 2024 and might be up for grabs from Democrats.
And what strikes me as interesting about this right now is because as Trump rose, there were plenty of Democrats who said, that's so bad, you can't be attracted to that. And guess what? Voters said, you know what? We'll make up our minds about that. I wonder if Republicans are finding themselves in a similar place. Like, you can't be attracted by that. And voters are saying, guess what? We'll decide what we're attracted to.
Absolutely. And I think for J.D. Vance to sort of put out this appeal, I think it's maybe a bit more palatable to voters who truly are undecided or voters who may have liked Trump in 2024 and aren't so sure now. And for J.D. Vance, who's considering a presidential run,
very much so.
I think it certainly does sort of cast him in a light that's maybe more moderate than his boss.
Julie Grace, you have a newsletter, lots of stuff in it. What's uppermost on your mind?
Ooh, so this week we had Nancy Mace, who has introduced a bill to ban staff from living with their bosses. She broke some news semi-recently, also in the newsletter, on Abe Hamadeh living with a staffer, which would be caused a lot of issues within his office and some issues there. So she had moved forward with all arguing that this needed to be prevented for sexual misconduct, et cetera. But then
blurring of lines and things like that.
So I talked to, I think, six of her former staffers who were like, well, she was living with her campaign manager during her first run and renting.
Not romantically,
her house.
But
not
just
romantically.
Like, yes, but just there.
And I had spoken to one of her staffers who was like, she used to have me crash at her house instead of a hotel some of the time. So
to save money, like, and other things. Yeah. So it doesn't exactly line up, as we say. Caroline Leavitt is gone, stepping down. Any idea who might replace her or when that might happen?
So a number of names have been floated. Anna Kelly, the principal White House press secretary, Caroline's deputy, you know, she's certainly top of mind. You know, you've even heard CNN's Scott Jennings floated. Julie Grace, actually, we were chatting about this before and, you know, talking about some other potential contenders. But sources inside the White House and outside of the White House tell me there doesn't really seem to be a huge rush to replace Caroline Leavitt. Remember, just a few months ago when she was on maternity leave, they fared pretty well without her, with that rotating cast of characters. And at the end of the day, the president is his best.
President is number one, press secretary, communications director, and all that. Julia Manchester, Julie Grace Brufke, thank you. I didn't even have a drink and I stumbled on that. Forgive
me. There you go.
Quick reminder, The Takeout is available as a podcast on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, and everywhere else. You can find each show there and our long-form interviews, of which we do many. I'm very happy to say that it's been a long day for me. Happy Friday, everyone. This is The Takeout, relentlessly curious, reliably civil, occasionally clever.